There are people whose great glory and whose besetting defect is that you can't sum them up. They were too many things, they did too much, they refused to be confined within one discipline. Such men and women trail across their contemporary skies like comets, dazzling their era, and the obituaries, gasping at how they straddled art, science, dog breeding, music, cross-country skiing or whatever, are extraordinary. But to be good at something else too can be fatal, and history, more prey to the mental soundbite than it likes to think, can be unkind to people of whom, in 30 words, you cannot easily complete the Wikipedia sentence beginning, "Lucinda X was." If you can't, a quarter of a century after a man of many parts has died and the dust has settled, winnow down his or her life, those many parts into one dominating part, the thing they, in inverted commas, mainly were, then they may be sunk. Leonardo da Vinci just about broke through the pinch of history. Few others have. Let's see if my guest today can do that for his choice of great life. He's been responsible for some of Britain's best-loved comedies, major TV landmarks that have punctuated the last 30 years. Not the 9 o'clock News, Spitting Image, Blackadder, and QI among them. There's also Museum of Curiosity here on Radio 4, and in a former life as a radio producer, he launched the News Quiz, quote-unquote, and the News Headlines. John Lloyd worked closely with Douglas Adams on bringing Hitchhiker's Guide to the airwaves, and is, I gather, of the same opinion as Plato. Unmitigated seriousness has no place in human affairs. John Lloyd, at first sight, it would appear that you've not chosen a great entertainer as your great life, though he was, perhaps, something of a showman. Who was he?
His name, which may not be familiar to that many people in your audience, is Richard Buckminster Fuller. And he was the most extraordinary person, and not just for what he achieved, but for who he was and who he became. He was one of the great scientists, in my view, of the 20th century, perhaps of history altogether. He wasn't just that, though. He was an architect, a designer, a philosopher, and also a generally good egg. One of the reasons we haven't heard of him is because school tends to major on a set of agreed clichés, and this happens across the board in history and science and so on. So we've all heard of Henry VIII, and we've all heard of Leonardo and Isaac Newton and Einstein, but we haven't heard of, most of us, Niels Bohr or James Clerk Maxwell or Giordano Bruno or hundreds and hundreds of other people.
I do agree with you, and I don't. You said that no one has ever heard of him. Ever since I discovered that you had chosen Buckminster Fuller, I've been asking people, what is this about Buckminster Fuller? Who was he? Everybody I've spoken to sort of recognises the name. Nobody I've spoken to quite remembers what it exactly it was that he did. But he was Richard Buckminster Fuller, 1895 to 1983, an otherworldly visionary whose time, it might be argued, has come now. Even had a molecule named after him because of its resemblance to his geodesic domes, hundreds of thousands of which have been built since the 1950s. There's even one in Antarctica, withstanding winds of up to 180 miles an hour.
Yes, you'll have seen one perhaps at the Eden Project, which covers that, or the Houston Astrodome, for example. So that's perhaps his most obvious contribution to things.
I've got a picture here of a geodesic dome, beloved, of Buckminster Fuller. It's just this picture, just a little corner of what is obviously a huge globe whose exterior is entirely characterised by triangles. But you can see from looking at this picture that it's not just in two dimensions, but in three. In depth, it goes into triangles so that there are triangles all the way through the body of this great sphere. And the first thing you see when you look at it is the head of a dandelion in many ways, this resonance or echoing between science
and nature. Well, interesting, you see, what it immediately reminds me of is a close-up of skin.
Really?
Yes, the crisscross lines on skin and the pores and the little holes in it.
Also with us is Hardin Tibbs, who sits on the jury of the Buckminster Fuller Institute's annual challenge. This awards designers who are engaging with and applying Fuller's ideas. Hardin, you're not an architect, but trained as an industrial designer. You describe yourself now as a strategy consultant and futurist. What does Buckminster Fuller mean to you?
Well, he means much more than I think I'd realised. In thinking about this over the last few days, I realised that he had shaped my thinking a great deal. I would say that he's easily one of the most interesting figures of the 20th century, which makes it all the more extraordinary that so few people know of him or know very much about him. And I think the way I would explain it is to pick up this analogy with Leonardo da Vinci. And this is not just a sort of casual analogy. He really is very much like da Vinci in many ways. If you consider that da Vinci was in part an architect, as Buckminster Fuller was, he experimented with maps. Leonardo also created geometrical shapes as a way of exploring mathematical relationships. He made a number of inventions, particularly, you know, the idea of the helicopter, the glider, which were, in a sense, prophetic. Perhaps the one point of difference with Leonardo would be that Leonardo also developed weapons, whereas Buckminster Fuller, although some of his inventions were used by the military, and he used to say that, in fact, the military very often invested in things that were needed ahead of the sort of civilian economy, but Buckminster Fuller talked about the idea of livingry, applying technology to help people to live better, looking at the technology that existed at the early part of the 20th century and saying, well, how do we really use this technology to make it possible for everybody to live in a comfortable state and to do it without spoiling the environment and so on? And when you consider that he was asking these questions in the 1920s and that probably the rest of the world didn't catch up with those sorts of questions until maybe the 1970s, you can see just how far ahead of things he was.
Let's hear the man himself. In the 1960s, Buckminster Fuller rather enjoyed the adulation of the caftan-clad hippies and jetted around the world's campuses, preaching his early version of environmentalism. You can imagine him, arms waving excitedly, his eyes flashing behind thick glasses, selling his dreams of a better tomorrow, beginning with an appreciation of where we are today.
Hello, astronauts. You're all astronauts. Our little spaceship Earth is literally moving around the sun at 60,000 miles an hour, 1,000 miles a minute. And we're moving through our Milky Way system at about 1,000 times that speed. So when people say to me, I don't know how you can stand all that travel, I say, you don't know what you're doing.
Buckminster Fuller, metaphysical showman, and boy, could he talk.
I put in four equal hour triangles around each vertex, and that becomes the octahedron. I can have five equal hour triangles around each vertex, and that's the icosahedron. If I insert a six equal hour triangle, each of the vertexes would be 360 degrees and never return upon itself, therefore it will not subdivide the universe. So there are only three cases of omnitriangular subdivisions of universe, the tetrahedron, the octahedron, and the icosahedron.
A fast-talking circus huckster combined with a dazzling intellect. I guess that though he was a great deal more than an entertainer, he was, and perhaps I was wrong to suggest otherwise at the beginning, John, he was at least a great entertainer.
Yes, now I've never heard him speak, you see. I'm allowed to spend my life with my nose in books.
Is that what you'd expected? Is that the voice you'd have imagined?
Yes, but you can hear the warmth in it, can't you? The reason he's talking so quickly, he's got so much to say, hasn't he? I've got to get on with this and I've got to inspire you to do it. And you can rather imagine the students sitting there and going away and just being completely blown away by this and feeling that they had to do something with their life. A lot of the stuff that he learned and discovered in life, he learned from looking at nature. A lot of his theories of triangles and shapes were based on how protons and neutrons, you know, fit together. And he looked and saw that the triangle, the tetrahedron particularly, is all through nature. It's right through it and nobody's noticed it before.
Did he, in fact, Hardin, apart from all the things that he inspired directly, did he inspire other people? Is there now a generation of Fullerites or Fullerines or whatever they're called?
Well, he did inspire a great number of people. It sort of worked its way into what they do. The architect Norman Foster, for instance, we are all familiar with the Gherkin. Well, the Gherkin, in a sense, is an elongated geodesic dome. Norman Foster worked with Bucky earlier on in his career. These influences are showing up everywhere. Perhaps another point to be made that's become more popular recently. The idea of biomimicry has also become popular more recently, and in a sense, Buckminster Fuller was the original proponent of biomimicry.
Well, what is biomimicry?
Well, biomimicry is the idea that nature, over millions of years of evolution, has already solved many engineering problems, and so there are a great number of things that you can look at in the form of butterfly wings for producing colour without pigment or whatever it might be, that can then be emulated by science and technology. in a sense, Buckminster Fuller was going to the deepest level of that kind of thinking, because he, this is really where he came to rethink the triangle, the significance of the triangle. He wasn't taking a triangle and asking himself what it meant. He was really asking himself, well, what are the most fundamental kinds of relationships in the universe? He liked to talk about universe rather than the universe, because he didn't think it was an object.
But he was more than just a Renaissance man. He had ideas about humanity, almost about the meaning of life, didn't he?
Yes, he came from a family of a slightly obscure sect called the Transcendentalists, of whom the two most famous, perhaps, are Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. And these guys and their followers believed that the divine was manifested both in humanity and in nature. And they had a mysterious sense of kind of holism, really, which I think Buckminster Fuller inherited by osmosis when he was young, but then he came to it much later in life when he had a kind of awful crisis in his late 20s. He had a beloved daughter called Alexandra, who was only 4, and she became ill during the First World War of meningitis, and his wife nursed this little girl through this thing, and I think she also got polio. Because she was very ill, she said to Buckminster Fuller, who at Harvard, his big love had been playing football, American football, and he'd injured himself, and he always walked with a cane when he was young. And his little 4-year-old daughter said, "Daddy, could I have a cane as a present?" And he went off to Harvard to watch some old mates play football, and as you do, afterwards they went to the pub and they had a few drinks, and by the most awful mischance, during that day, his daughter had fallen into a coma from which he was never to recover, and he rushed home. He was absolutely distraught. He loved this little girl, got to her bedside, and she came out of the coma briefly to say, "Daddy, did you remember the cane?" And he'd completely forgotten about it, and shortly afterwards she died. And it's the most awful story on the face of it. And the poor man, he just became completely distraught. Everything fell to bits. He started drinking. His business went into ruins. His father-in-law gave him the sack and sold the business off in a kind of fire sale. You know, he and his wife, as often happens with the death of a child, you know, started falling out, and he went and had an affair with somebody. He just went completely down the tubes. And it culminated in an incident when he was, by this time, in his early 30s, his life in ruins, the girl had left him, his wife wasn't speaking to him, and he stood on the shores of Lake Michigan contemplating suicide. And at that point, he had a vision from nowhere, I suppose, from the sky, saying, "You're not entitled to kill yourself. Everybody's here to help each other," or something of that kind. And from that moment, he kind of picked himself up and completely transformed his life. And that's one of the other reasons I so admire him. I think there should be a word for this, Matthew. It should be called overcumption, okay? It's the ability to overcome adverse circumstances. And this man did that in spades. He went on from that. He hadn't really done a great deal up
to
that point.
You co-authored The Meaning of Life with Special Words, didn't you?
I did.
Yes. Overcumption.
Overcumption. Well, it isn't in The Meaning of Life because it's not the name of a town.
Mm.
But perhaps if we could find a town that would be willing to, rather like that town in America, Truth or Consequences, you know, that was named after an American game show. We wrote a QI book recently called The QI Book of the Dead, which has 69 biographies in it, chosen from, we think, around 90 billion human beings in the whole of history have lived. We picked 69 of our favourites, and Buckminster Fuller's certainly one of mine. What happens in the book is everybody has a tough time. Plato, who you mentioned earlier, Plato used to say one of my favourite quotes, "Be kind, for everyone is fighting a hard battle." I mean, whatever your circumstances in life, you know, whether you're born rich or poor, you're going to get trouble somewhere along the line. And what distinguishes a human being from an anthropoid biped is the people who are able to overcome the adverse circumstances in which they find themselves and make something of themselves. And what Buckminster Fuller did, he didn't just make something of himself, he made something for everybody. In many ways, we don't realise how much he transformed the world at the time in the way that we think about it, and he hasn't finished yet. And this is the thing that... It is the most extraordinary thing. It's what QI is based on. I had a similar crisis. Fortunately, I didn't have a child who died unexpectedly, but a similar crisis in my early 40s where you suddenly lose the plot of what's happening And I started, for the first time in my life, thinking of things for myself rather than what I've been told. There's a great quote from Buckminster Fuller. He used to say that he had faith, he acquired faith through this tragedy in his life, and he said, faith is much better than belief. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. And that's the thing, that if you start thinking for yourself and you start looking at simple things, patterns and shapes and so on, you suddenly realise how extraordinary the universe is. And this is something that never leaves you. We get it from Bizarre Facts on QI. You can't, if you've done QI research, look at something like a leaf or a tree again and think it's ordinary. You see that everything is intensely interesting.
You're listening to Great Lives with me, Matthew Paris, discussing the life of Buckminster Fuller, arch-pragmatist yet utopian thinker, all rolled into one, as nominated by John Lloyd and Hardin Tibbs. Hardin, the list of his inventions is almost endless.
Yes, sir. He invented, or shall we say reinvented, the house, the car, the bathroom, the shower, the world map, and it goes on.
Was it he who invented that world map that appears like lots of peelings of orange?
Yes.
That's spread out flat.
His so-called Dymaxion map, which is his attempt to create a world map with no distortion whatsoever in terms of the continents. So the whole thing is composed of triangles.
Which brings us to Fuller the inventor. We've said a little bit about where some of his ideas and thoughts pointed. He wrote out the personal crisis we were talking about and re-emerged, so the story goes, with some clearer goals and sense of direction. And this, Hardin, is where his inventions really begin flying off the drawing board. Tell us about some of them.
Well, there are so many that it's hard to know where to begin, but a theme that runs all the way through is his rethinking of buildings. He had a trade name for his inventions, the word Dymaxion, which meant doing more with less.
Well, what's the actual origin of Dymaxion? How is the word constructed?
Dynamic and maximum. This was coined for him by a marketing person who was helping him with an exhibition he was doing at one point. Up to that time, he'd referred to his own inventions as being 4D because he introduced the extra dimension of time to the three-dimensional world.
Did he have a sense of beauty, do you think, John? I know it can be argued that nature is beautiful and science is beautiful and the crystalline structure of this, that or the other is beautiful. But apart from allowing what I suppose you or he would say, the intrinsic beauty of things to emerge, did he have ideas of style and grace and beauty that he was able to impose on the world or the things that he designed?
Well, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. I think the universe is paradoxical because, yes, it is beautiful in some ways. It's also extremely ugly. You know, it is in many ways benevolent and also cruel. You can't separate the two, and it's like Buckminster Fuller and his attention to detail and his holism. You have to have both things.
I wonder, though, whether with Fuller, though we all call him a polymath and talk about his great philosophical understanding as well as his scientific and mathematical abilities, whether he wasn't a little bit naive about human nature. This idea of everybody living together and achieving things through synergy and efficiency presupposes a huge element of goodwill, a consensus, which all through his life he must surely have failed to observe. He saw the First World War, he saw the Second World War, he did quite well out of both of them, he saw the Vietnam War. Did he not lose confidence in the propensity of mankind to want to live in the synergetic ways that he proposed?
He used to talk about humanity's final exam. I think he thought that it wasn't that he didn't recognise that human nature was what it was, but I think he felt that we were moving towards a really significant crisis. And I think that's much more apparent now than it was back in the 1920s and 30s.
Yes, well, Spaceship Earth, It's Not Too Late for a Course Correction, was what the Huffington Post wrote, reviewing a major Buckminster Fuller retrospective at the Whitney in New York. Perhaps he did think that we were heading, if we didn't correct our course, for some sort of cataclysm.
He was interested in discovering what it was that we would need to do as a species in order to save ourselves, in effect. I think the question of whether these things were going to be practical or whether they were going to be done was not so important as to propose or to try to discover what those would be if we did have the will to do them.
Yes, incredibly prescient in that way. I mean, again, way, way ahead of his time. We'll still have people who are sceptical about a lot of his ideas.
This was a man who was driven by his intention to achieve, in his words, more for less. He put it like this: to make the world work for 100% of humanity, in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological offence or disadvantage of anyone. A tall order. You think that he may be getting close to success from beyond the grave?
I think he's one of those people. I mean, Leonardo perhaps is another whose legacy is much larger. Do you remember that book, Fermat's Last Theorem? Mm. Simon Singh, wasn't it? Which they only just managed to solve this bloke's theorem like 300 years later. I think Buckminster Fuller's a little bit like that, is that there's a whole mine of stuff that he thought about and designed and sketched out that we haven't really used yet. I think anybody who's trying to do something with which they are obsessed about trying to improve something in a certain way is going to get terribly frustrated. You can't help it. But it seemed to me, I think there are certain people who go through a crisis in their life where they think, like when his daughter died, there can't be anything worse than that. I cannot imagine how terrible it must be to have your four-year-old daughter, your only four-year-old daughter at the time, die. And I think that he made at some point, after several years getting completely drunk and behaving terribly badly, he thought, right, I'm going to clean myself up and I'm going to make some sort of contribution. Again, in the literature, it goes right back to the ancient Chinese philosophy. You know, if you want happiness for a lifetime, help the younger generation. That there is unquestionably, with nuns and people who work in charities and people who live altruistically, these people have a kind of such a deep self-confidence that the way that acting right is an important and good thing to do, that they somehow are able to survive the stuff, the crap of life that makes the rest of us very cross indeed, you know, war and terrorism and so on. You see the whole picture of things, perhaps. And at the end of the day, all that counts, he used to say, the only thing that counts in living your life is integrity. It is both necessary and sufficient, he said.
Yes, there was a philosophical thread running through alongside all of these inventions that were, and when you read even his most technical dissertations, he's constantly stepping aside to make philosophical remarks, you know, so that this is of a piece with his thinking. And in talking about the geometry of thinking or the geometry of philosophy, these kinds of ideas, which don't make any sense in ordinary kind of academic terms, but it was very much blended in the way he looked at things.
You see that also, you see that continually in all the great scientists of the 20th century. Einstein, Niels Bohr, Max Planck, James Clerk Maxwell's a very good example. All of these people who started out as sort of hard scientists, physics, things, bits and pieces, they all became philosophers towards the end of their life. Erwin Schrödinger, for example, of Schrödinger's cat fame, wrote a book called What is Life? An extraordinary book. I think it's impossible to look at the world at that level of detail and understanding and not see that ultimately, fundamentally, it remains completely mysterious.
After half an hour of almost unmitigated enthusiasm for Buckminster Fuller, I must put a hard question to end with. He may well have been right. He may have had the most marvellous ideas. Lots of the things that he said may well have been true or may well come true. And yet, ask around among our generation who was Buckminster Fuller, and nobody seems to remember quite what it was that he was. So he must have got something wrong. Now, come on, try and think of what it was that he got wrong, Hardin.
Well, I suppose, you know, I mentioned earlier the idea of prophetic invention that can't be realised at the time when it's proposed, but maybe later it comes into its own. So I think that some of the specific things that he proposed will probably never be used in that form. But the question he was asking, the principles that he discovered and was attempting to apply, that those, sooner or later, we will find ourselves actually adopting those ideas. And I think that's the true significance of his contribution. And he also did say that many things, many of the concepts he introduced, he felt would take at least 25 years before it was going to be possible to apply them. And he also, towards the end of his life, said that he didn't think that his real significance would be understood for a considerable time. So you may be right. He may, in the end, be irrelevant. But on the other hand, maybe it's too soon to tell.
John Lloyd, there's a wonderful passage in Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of St. Louis Ray about a 18th century abbess who was also a little bit of a feminist. And Wilder says that she was one of those people who had the misfortune to recognise an idea about a century before its appointed arrival in the history of mankind, and spent her life throwing herself against the obstinacy of her times. Could that be Buckminster Fuller?
I think it very well could. I've been struggling, listening to Hardin talk, to try and think of some negative qualities. I read somewhere that geodesic domes have a tendency to leak. Do you know if that's true?
Yes, I have.
They've got so many joins.
Yes, it definitely is a concern.
So we definitely score that. He's also had the slightly weird habit of wearing three watches, so that whenever he travelled, he'd have one watch for the time zone he'd just come from, one the one he was in and the one he was going to. But I think that's rather lovable eccentricity. Years ago, in this very building, I used to have to write an annual report for my secretary, who was absolutely wonderful. And I wrote this report, and you have to go and report again to your head of department. And this guy said, "You haven't put down her bad points as well as her good points." And I said, "Well, I don't think she has any bad points. I think she's absolutely wonderful." He said, "Are you sleeping with her?" So I'm not sleeping with Buckminster Fuller, and never have. But I just want to share this one transcendentalist quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Okay, so lived, you know, nearly a century before Bucky Fuller. "The purpose of life is not to be happy. It is to be useful, to be honourable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well."
My thanks to John Lloyd and Hardin Tibbs. By Buckminster Fuller's death, he had registered 25 US patents, written 28 books, travelled round the globe 57 times, and received 47 honorary doctorates, as well as numerous other awards, including a 1969 nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. Yet his legacy is still open for edit. Was he an obsessive prophet of gleaming technological progress, or a pioneering, radically outspoken defender of the environment? Broadcaster Ray Gosling remembers helping Watford School of Art build a bamboo dome in the Tuileries Gardens in Paris in the mid-1960s in honour of the man himself, who came and sat in there with the students, huddled around the hurricane lamps, and boy, did he talk. So I'll get my last word in edgeways while I can. Goodbye.
He wanted students to hang a big ball to dangle outside the 20th floor of the United Nations building in New York, like a magic lantern. And he'd have electronically recorded on its skin all the facts of the world's wonderful resources as they constantly change. The world at a glance. And somehow, by the magic of this electronic lantern, once we students showed the facts of what there was in the world to the leaders of the world, eureka! Mankind would have success. An end to weaponry and killingry, and a vote for peace and livingry. Ideas on a cosmic scale. What a brain.